From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. More staggering job losses today as the coronavirus crisis continues. Another 5.2 million people filed for unemployment over the past week, bringing the total from the past 4 weeks to 22 million people.
And Jeremy, as we know, President Trump has been pushing to get people back to work. At his briefing later today, he's expected to outline ways that those in some states with low infection rates can do just that on May 1st, if not before. But he's running into pushback, not just from medical experts, from some governors, from Americans. Polls show a huge majority don't want the country open too soon. And business leaders are calling for testing. Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa wrote about the president's efforts to enlist big business names in his economic advisory group. And Robert, you say many were surprised to hear their names read out in the Rose Garden yesterday.
They were surprised. In conversations with lobbyists and business executives on Wednesday, it became clear that many businesses were surprised about the president deciding to read their names. They were encouraging of the president's efforts to involve them in the pandemic response. But you do see the White House, based on our reporting, scrambling to try to get business executives in line, almost in lockstep with the president as he moves closer to a decision on when to reopen the economy.
Yeah, or at least even get their permission to be on the council. And many were in a series of phone calls with the president yesterday. Some spoke to you and said business leaders expressed concerns about testing. And tell us how so and how did the president respond?
The president acknowledged their concerns, but there's still a lot of debate inside the administration about what the metrics should be for testing. The FDA at this moment, I just spoke with Stephen Hahn, the head of the FDA this morning, has three antibody tests out there, but they're still trying to figure out what's the reliability of these tests. And companies want to know there's a testing system in place that protects them in terms of liability, that protects their employees coming back to the workplace. And those details at this late date in April still need to be worked out.
Yeah. Well, we know yesterday the presidential task force member, Dr. Deborah Birx, said nine states had less than 1,000 coronavirus cases, less than 30 new cases every day. Of course, that's not counting for, you know, maybe the lack of testing. But, you know, the president is going to unveil plans today for states like that. What have we heard about that, what the plan might be? And then who's the decider, the president or the governors?
While the president says he has, quote, total authority, it does come down to what governors want to do. But the White House, for political cover, to not be seen isolated out on a limb, they are relying on governors, friendly governors in many instances, moving forward before the White House. And you see Greg Abbott of Texas, a Republican close to President Trump. He wants to open Texas as soon as possible. He's going to issue an executive order this week. But what you're going to see is a phased reopening around May 1st that allows different states to take their own states and make their own decisions with the blessing and encouragement of President Trump.
And things like maybe schools, is the president going to go that deep in his plan or leave that to the states?
States have control over the school system. The Department of Education can make certain recommendations, but that will again come down to governors.
Right, right. Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, we mentioned polls of Americans, including one from Politico and Morning Consult, that showed a majority of Americans don't want to reopen the country too soon. Well, in Michigan, protesters made it clear it can't come soon enough. Thousands in cars and then on foot jammed the streets of Lansing, the Michigan state capital, yesterday to protest Governor Gretchen Whitmer's statewide stay-at-home order. There was little social distancing or face masks, but this comes after similar protests in Ohio and North Carolina. Abigail Sensky of member station WKAR in Lansing was there. So, Abigail, the governor says there's a need for this stay-at-home order for the public health. You spoke to some of the protesters. What was their reasoning?
Well, I spoke to one woman who was recently laid off on the west side of the state at a local greenhouse. And she said, you know, she understands that the governor needs to do something to slow the spread of COVID-19 in our state, but she wants her greenhouse to be able to reopen. She's from a county with a low number of cases, and she said she can't quite wrap her mind around why her county with 74 cases has to follow the same restrictions as Detroit with more than 7,000 cases. And she's worried small businesses are going to go under.
Yeah.
She just wants small businesses to be able to open up when it's safe. And that was true for, you know, a lot of the protesters there who are seeking industry-based or regional-based exemptions.
Yeah, it is hard to wrap your head around something that's happening across the country. But of course, you know, the viruses travel. Somebody from across the country could come right to your neighborhood. But, you know, this is not, these are not people who don't believe that the coronavirus exists.
Yeah, you know, everyone there, you know, knows this is serious. But I think the hard thing for the state of Michigan is we've been at this for more than a month, but it hasn't hit the state all of the same. 78% of cases here are in Detroit or three counties in southeast Michigan. And Monday, more than a million or a quarter of our state's workforce have applied for unemployment benefits here. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of lack of understanding, you know, for people who aren't seeing the virus in their communities. Yeah. They don't understand why they have to follow the same stringent stay-at-home order.
And you also expressed that there's some pain, but we know that a conservative group organized the protest and the governor is a Democrat. Did you get a sense that some of it was just political?
Yeah, so certainly there were about 200 people who left their cars, and the people who left their cars, you know, those people were ardent Trump supporters. There were lots of MAGA hats and Keep American Great flags. There was a militia that gathered at the Capitol steps, and there were certainly fringe conservatives who were there, but there were also thousands more who stayed in their cars. Mm. There were 3,000 to 4,000 people there yesterday, and the people who didn't get out, we don't know what right. their politics are. There's, you know, in my yeah. sense, there's a lot of small business owners and employees who are just scared yep. they're going to permanently lose their jobs or yep. businesses.
KAR's Abigail Sensky, thank you so much.
Of course.
Well, now let's go to a country that you could say is Europe's California. Aggressive shutdown measures early on that have led to far fewer cases and deaths than neighboring areas. I'm talking about Greece, and NPR's Joanna Kakissis joins us from Athens. Hi, Joanna.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Greece has around 2,000 cases of coronavirus and about 100 deaths, compared with Italy with 165,000 cases and 21,000 deaths. What is the explanation for those numbers?
Well, you know, the Greek government saw the writing on the wall when it came to Italy. Italy's right next door, and it was so scary for the Greeks to see so much suffering there that the government decided early on that they had to take immediate, pretty drastic steps. They started closing down the country in phases early last month, shutting down schools, shutting down shops. And then we went into sort of complete lockdown in the middle of the month. And we can't, you know, people can't go out unless they have a slip from the government allowing them to go to the supermarket, to the drugstore, to the doctor. They wanted to keep people at home so they could do things like send out mobile testing units and test as many people as they could. They also used the time to increase the number of ICU beds and to add equipment. The other thing that the government did that it was pretty remarkable for a Greek government is they stood up to the Greek Orthodox Church. You know, the church did not want to shut down services in the run-up to Easter because Easter is the most important holiday in Greece. And they actually are prosecuting a priest next month who did hold an illegal service during this time. So the Greeks are trying to buy time so they can prepare themselves for what's next.
And by the way, unlike the Easter that was celebrated in many parts of the world last weekend, the Greek Easter is coming up this Sunday. Joanna, are people listening to the government? Are they following these orders?
You know, yeah, they have been. They've been taking this very seriously and following the rules, you know, religiously, even though they can't go to church. The church is very powerful here, but, you know, ultimately Greeks trust doctors and scientists over priests. And the prime minister has handed over the communication about COVID-19 to scientists like the Harvard-trained infectious diseases doctor, whose name is Sotiris Tsiodras. He's really good at explaining the dangers of this disease to Greeks. He's got a briefing every day, and Greeks, like, watch it every night like, you know, it's the most important show ever. People are following the rules.
Joanna, tourism is a huge part of the Greek economy. We're coming up on the summer season. Do the people on the islands in Greece expect there to be any tourists this year?
No, and they are obviously very upset. 20% of Greece's GDP comes from tourism revenue. And, you know, everything is shut down here. There are only a few hotels operating, no tour buses, no ferries, you know, nothing of the kind that is usually starting up about this time of year. So the government is looking at rescue packages right now, how to help various hoteliers and restaurant owners and people who profit from tourism. But the concern is, you know, the International Monetary Fund predicts that the Greek economy is going to take a huge hit because of the coronavirus pandemic, and is the economy is expected to shrink by 10%. That's just horrible news for a country that just got out of, you know, this incredibly difficult, long economic depression in which people suffered hugely, and so many, right. Unemployment was at one point up to 27%.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis joining us from Athens, Greece. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
With new numbers out today, more than 22 million people have filed for unemployment benefits in just the last few weeks. That's 13% of the American workforce. And as those numbers continue to rise, the pressure is on for the government to find a responsible way to reopen the economy. Joining us now for more on that is one of this country's leading economists, Professor Kenneth Rogoff at Harvard University. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. A pleasure to speak with you.
Well, when do you expect the economy to reopen?
Boy, that is a tough call, really, for the health specialists. I suspect we will try to reopen and it won't work, and we'll end up shutting down maybe for a shorter period next time. That's been the experience in other countries. Singapore tried to be more open. They've shut tight. Japan tried to. And I think, you know, at some point we could stay shut forever and then wouldn't have a problem. We'd be back in the Stone Ages at some point. So we're going to experiment. My guess is the first experiments with reopening will happen towards the end of May, beginning of June. But I don't see this ending fully smoothly and quickly.
When you talk about the risks of reopening too soon and having to go back into a more of a lockdown situation, what are the risks of staying closed for too long as you see them?
Well, we are headed into the deepest dive in the global economy basically in 150 years. And it's, of course, there are risks in staying this way. Unemployment is going to go up to levels, you know, we haven't really seen maybe since the Great Depression. There are all kinds of problems associated with that, you know, malnutrition in children and mental health problems, children not getting education, other health problems, cancer, whatever, getting deferred and not treated the same way because our hospitals are overwhelmed. There's a lot of problems to manage in what is a natural catastrophe where it isn't easy to make the call. The good news, such as there is that there are a lot of places in the world experiencing the same challenges, approaching it in different ways. And hopefully we can look at the experiences of other countries, ranging from some who, you know, locked down more severely than we have, many have, like France, certainly China at its height, to others, particularly in the developing world, where they can't. They just can't shut down their economy, and they have to sort of let come what may. And we'll learn a lot. I mean, that's a very grim situation, but we will know a lot more in a few months. And also, of course, our medical researchers are furiously working on this, trying to understand it better.
You know, I feel like about a month ago when we would talk to economists, they would say, well, we're kind of expecting this to be a V-shaped recovery where, you know, all we have to do is keep people with enough money for a few months to get through this, and then everything will come roaring right back afterwards. And I feel like I'm hearing less of that now. What do you think about how this recovery is going to look?
Well, optimistically, they will find better medical treatments than we now think of. We'll get a vaccine sooner than we expect. But I think realistically, even in countries like the United States, no, we're just not going to get what's so-called V-shaped recovery, where just you go down, but you snap up really fast. That seems really unlikely. I mean, there are a number of reasons. First, we're going to only be able to open the country gradually. Second, as we just discussed, there's going to be at best two steps forward and one step back where we have to close up for a while. But lastly, this is causing a lot of damage. I think there are a lot of small businesses that are not going to make it back, some from financial problems and some because the economy is being turned upside down. I don't know what it's going to look like at the end of this, but there'll be a lot of restructuring, more online businesses, maybe less face-to-face things. And there may be jobs in the end, but it's going to take time. You don't just snap back. So, you know, I don't want to be overly pessimistic because I just don't know the health side. But my guess is that this will be a slow recovery, maybe not as slow as the last 10 years where, you know, it just stayed slow almost till the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be a bit faster. But in a typical recession, you're just snapping back the next 6 months. That's really unlikely here.
If the U.S. is going to continue to spend trillions of dollars to try to stabilize the economy and help it bounce back faster, what kinds of things would you want the U.S. to be spending that money on? I can't imagine that a huge infrastructure project would even be possible because it's hard for people to go out and work together on things right now. But is universal health care something that should be looked at right now, something that is going to cost trillions of dollars, but maybe this is the moment to do it?
Well, I think surely we're going to have universal health care come out of this, and whether it's in 2 years or 6 years, that's clearly one of the things that is a weakness that's been shown. Mind you, Italy has universal health care, France has universal health care, Spain has universal health care, and, you know, it's not helped them. It's more a political thing. I mean, in the first instance, I would like to see them spending more and leaning on the private sector more to deliver the urgent things we need. I mean, it's not just the ventilators, but where are the tests for the virus? Why isn't it coming out faster? I mean, testing is the central thing, as all the health professionals are telling us, to be able to figure out how to deal with this rationally. What is the problem? How big is it? Where is it? What should we do? So I'd certainly like to see that. We do need a lot of infrastructure in the United States. I think we should have done a lot more before this. So, for example, providing free internet to everywhere, I think, would be a priority. We have this situation with all these children who aren't getting access to education because they don't have internet. There are certainly many needs, and possibly providing more online education, not just for children, not just for college students, for adults, so that we can have a more flexible economy. I mean, there are a lot of directions, certainly, that we can go. Some of it will be determined politically. But again, in the near term, we're in an incredible crisis of trying to normalize in some way, and we need to devote enormous courage, resources, and creativity to try to deal with it.
One direction that we are likely to go in, according to many experts, including we just spoke recently with Mohamed El-Erian, the economist, who said he believes that this crisis will really exacerbate income inequality, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Do you agree with that?
Oh, goodness. I mean, if we're talking about around the world, we're seeing in places like India levels of humanitarian crises, tragedies like we have not seen outside of wartime. You have to understand all of these countries face the same problems we do. Small businesses can't be open. People can't go to work. They need to deal with the health problems. And they don't have the resources to deal with it. They not only can't borrow, they have debts to pay. I have argued that we really should have a moratorium on debt repayments, not just for homeowners and small businesses like we're doing here, but a lot of the emerging world and developing economies. We went through this period where, if you looked at a global level, the world became much more equal because billions of people rose out of extreme poverty. Unfortunately, this is going to be very, very big step backwards in Africa, places like India, maybe even in places like Brazil and Mexico. So it's absolutely a formative moment in the global system. And there's a possibility that it'll look like the 1930s, where everything became balkanized, every country for themselves. And that sure didn't work very well, and it didn't lead to anything good.
How could we allow ourselves, and I'm not just talking about the United States, but the entire world, allow our entire global economy to be screwed up by a pandemic that, you know, is something that, not on this scale, but a pandemic is something that we do experience every, you know, decade or so in some level?
Well, this has certainly been forecast. So I've been on numerous meetings, sometimes with high-level officials, with health authorities saying, look, you know, this could happen. And I think a lot of people poo-pooed it and said, well, we'll come up with some drug, we'll deal with it, science is, you know, going to deal with the problem. A lot of people want to pretend we live in a world where crises don't happen. There's never going to be a Great Depression. There's never going to be a war. There's never going to be a pandemic. And I think you have to plan for these. And it's just like when you buy house insurance so your home doesn't burn down. And then, you know, you go, oh, it didn't burn down the last 3 years. That was a waste of money. We need to think much more about these things and invest in them to prepare for these extreme events. I hope this doesn't happen again for 100 years, but my friends who are researchers say, well, you know, it could happen again in 10 years. Let's be prepared.
That is Kenneth Rogoff, a Harvard economist. Professor Rogoff, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In this era of social distancing, one thing you might have noticed are all kinds of stuffed animals crowding the windows of homes. It's part of a game some call a bear hunt. Mose Bouchel from member station KUT in Austin, Texas, took his kids out on their wagon for a hunt and came back with these tips.
Okay, kids.
They're walking.
My hunting partners were my 3-year-old boy, Moon.
Do you want to wear these binoculars?
No, I did these treats.
He loves sweets and treats.
Okay.
And my 5-year-old daughter, Una.
I pulled out the wagon.
Thank you, Una. This is our first bear hunt. The idea is people put out stuffed animals like teddy bears so kids can walk around to find them. It's like a scavenger hunt. The bear hunt name probably caught on because of that kid's song, Going on a Bear Hunt.
So you guys want to sing the bear hunt song?
No. No.
Okay.
We're going on a bear hunt.
We're going
Tip
on
one,
a bear
bring your phone. People who put out animals tag their houses online.
To start with, I'm going to look at this map.
Daddy, I'm going to open these sweets.
Tip two, bring nutritious snacks.
All right, I'll let you have some sweets.
Tip number three, watch out for grackles.
What just happened?
The bird pooped on me.
You know, they say that's good luck, though, Una.
Yeah. All right. I need the hose.
Oh, yeah, the hose. That's a good idea.
Okay, off we go. Tip four. As you walk, listen.
Does it seem kind of more quiet than usual?
Yeah, but it's nice.
Hardly any cars, hardly any planes. The birds seem louder, but everything else is eerily still.
And what about this restaurant?
It doesn't look like there's any people in it, because there's coronavirus in there.
Well, I don't know if it's in there, but there is a...
Sometimes people can get sick from the coronavirus.
Is that why we're all staying at home?
Mm-hmm. Here's a thought that's inescapable. People are losing their jobs, risking their lives. People are getting sick. And here I am, lucky enough to be hunting teddy bears.
Stop.
Our first sighting, the kid's friend's house down the street.
I see some animals there.
Oh, yeah, I see them.
There's a rabbit, a couple puppies, maybe a dinosaur thing. And the kids decide that I am a horse.
Go, yeah, horse, yeah. Yeah, horsey.
All right, I think there's some more up here.
Tip number 6. The kids are gonna want to look at your phone.
Hold on, Kate.
Tip number 7. Don't let them look at your phone.
Okay, here.
Why does Moni get to hold the telephone?
You can get a turn, too.
And I'm never going to give it to anyone. You always need to share. Sharing is caring. Moni's being mean to me.
I'm not.
Yeah, these things aren't always the way you envisioned them. Hey, guys, you know what? They just announced that we're going to be at home for another month.
For Here and Now, I'm Mose Bouchel.
And this week, California became the first state to provide emergency relief funds to undocumented immigrants. 150,000 of them will receive a one-time payment of $500. Helping to get the word out is Radio Indígena, a radio station in Oxnard, California, probably where your strawberries are coming from, that's been keeping indigenous farm workers who may not speak English or Spanish in the loop about the coronavirus. Genevieve Flores-Haro is the associate director. Hi, Genevieve.
Hi, how are you?
And just, you know, this is fascinating. First of all, this radio station, are your listeners pretty exclusively these workers?
We get a mix of different listeners just because our programming is broadcast in multiple languages. Mixteco, Zapoteco, Purépecha, Spanish and English.
Yeah. And you estimate there are about 20,000 indigenous immigrants in Ventura County alone. And these, I'm sure, make up the bulk of your listeners. How important is this communication to these farm workers who probably have communities through church, through, you know, the farms that they work at, but maybe even some of those are shut down right now. So how important is it to reach them?
It's very important to reach farm workers that do speak indigenous languages, given the nature that these languages are oral. So your typical flyer, whether it's in English or Spanish, one won't reach them. But even if you put the flyer in Mixteco, there's no written form. And so we found that audio and video have been a really critical way of reaching farm workers with important information that changes daily.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip from a broadcast you put out recently in Mixteco, just one of, you know, the many languages you mentioned, explaining what the coronavirus is and how to take precautions. Let's listen.
Coronavirus yoki inque esana kivikani inyo tanundi kio tacho. Nasami coronavirus yoki kwe kai dichikankani tai vinziva anti kio tacho.
We can catch words here and there, but as you said, this isn't Spanish. This is an indigenous language. And Genevieve, you know, some people might say, well, who doesn't know about the coronavirus? But these people might not.
Yeah, and that's what's been our experience going through this with our community the last couple of weeks. It was, you know, food's coming off the shelf, I can't find toilet paper, what's going on? And then informing people that, you know, there is this virus that's going on. These are the precautions you need to take. This is, you know, the reality. But a lot of folks were not aware.
Wow, to see toilet paper disappearing and not know why. And we understand there's not even a word for virus in Mixteco.
That's correct. You know, Mixteco, across the different variants, there is no direct translation. You have to describe what it is. So you have to describe the symptoms. You can say that it's like the flu, because there is a word for flu. But you just have to try and get as close as you can to what virus in English means.
Well, and this is a very important time for the state that needs them, for them that need the work, because we're getting into, as we said, strawberry season, huge crop where you are there in Oxnard. And the pay changes, explain that.
Yeah, so right now we're in what's called the piece rate season. So outside of the piece rate season, typically farm workers get paid hourly. But with the piece rate season, they are paid based off of the boxes that they pick. So there is an urgency to pick as many boxes as you can in order to bring home a bigger paycheck, essentially.
But as these workers find out about the virus through the radio station and, you know, elsewhere, you know, first of all, do they see any irony in the fact that, you know, most of the state is scrambling to stock up and batten down the hatches, and they're being told that they're essential when so many of them are, you know, unwelcome at other times? And also when they're being sent out into a pandemic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've spoken with farm workers at my organization where they're completely aware of that. And for them, the reality is, yes, they've been given this new title as heroic, but the reality for them, much like grocery workers, is at the end of the day, it's about putting food on the table. At the end of the day, it's about being able to pay their rent. But it's definitely not lost on them that even outside of this pandemic, you know, you had a federal administration that was telling them that they don't belong, that they should go back home, that they're not upstanding people. And so, yeah, it's definitely not lost on the community that we serve. You know, we, in our connections, see leaders who, you know, have a social media following, and, you know, they are able to post a picture of them on the fields and just reminding folks, like, hey, like, we're here, and it's these hands that feed you.
Yeah. How, you know, this could end in so many ways. It could be the thing we're hearing about that happens after huge crises, which is that there's change for workers, as there was, you know, after the 1917-18 flu, as there was after the Depression. You know, we can have the New Deal, a sense, a better appreciation of workers after they've worked through things like this. Or, I mean, there could be an outbreak in one of these areas and it could spread like wildfire. But what's your sense, what's your hope for what happens? Because people might pay attention to where their strawberries coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for many folks, they don't really think about the worker that picked their food, or they don't really think about the worker that packed their little clam of strawberries or raspberries. And so, you know, my hope after all this is done is that we see real change for farm workers. We see whether that's in terms of healthcare access, whether that's in terms of disability or unemployment benefits, whether it's in terms of just even their workplace, and how can we better support farm workers so that that workplace is safe and they have access to clean water, clean bathrooms, things of that nature. I think we are on the precipice of some major changes that are totally overdue for our farm workers who are there, you know, not just during a pandemic, but they're out there during wildfires. They're out there during the rainy season, making sure that, you know, it's their hands that feed us as a country.
That's Genevieve Flores-Haro talking about some of the challenges farm workers are facing. We'll link you to her group, the Mixteco Indigenous Community Organizing Project in Oxnard, and their radio station at herenow.org. Genevieve, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, many immigrants are out of work, and that means less money going to their home countries. Last year, immigrant workers here in the U.S. sent an estimated $150 billion to relatives, and half of that went to Latin America. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, without work, they and their families back home are struggling.
Earlier this month, the Beverly Hills boutique where 51-year-old Annabelle cleaned shut its doors. She was laid off without pay. The only job she has now is cleaning a nearby office building one day a week. Holding on to the small apartment she and her husband share is a top priority.
Tenemos que dejar de comer para pagar la renta.
We've had to cut back on food just to pay the rent, says Annabelle, who asked NPR to use only her first name because she does not have a work permit. After making rent, Annabelle sends whatever she can to El Salvador, where she supports her two adult children and three grandchildren.
Pudimos ponerle $50 porque no podemos nosotros también quedarnos sin nada acá.
Last week, I was only able to send them $50, she says. We have to leave something here. Annabelle says she's been waiting in long lines at churches and food banks, hoping to get some help so she can save enough to send more money next week to her daughters. Thinking about her mother going hungry is depressing, Elba Mariela, Annabelle's eldest daughter in El Salvador.
A la vez me pongo a pensar, a saber que dejó de pagar ella, a saber si ella tiene comida.
I just think about what she's going without and if she has food, she says. But Elba Mariela is hurting in El Salvador, too. It was one of the first countries in the region to close its borders and quarantine residents. Only one cousin in her extended family still has a job. The money her mom sends is more critical than ever. And that's the situation for millions around the world, says Manuel Orozco with the Washington, D.C.-based think tank, the Inter-American Dialogue.
You know, the numbers are just huge.
Especially in Latin America and the Caribbean. In Haiti, money sent from abroad accounts for a third of the economy. In Honduras, it's nearly a quarter. Even in Mexico, where dollars sent home are a small part of GDP, the losses will affect a lot of families, says Orozco.
You have to think about the households. 1.2 million households at least will not receive money this year. That's a big deal.
For now, Ari, a nanny for two small children in Washington, D.C., has been able to send money to her aging parents in Oaxaca, Mexico. That's because her employers are still paying her during the shutdown, but they say they don't know for how much longer. Ari's husband, a house painter, is barely working these days.
Veremos. Veremos cómo se puede hacer.
We will have to see what we will do next month, says Ari, who also asked NPR not to use her full name because she is working in the country illegally. Hopefully, the shutdown will be lifted soon, she says.
Para que pueda uno volver a generar y empezar a mandar otra vez.
That way, she says, we can go back to work and start sending money back home again. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
This is Here and Now. After postponing all oral arguments for March and April because of COVID-19, the Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear oral arguments by phone in May, including the case of President Trump's financial records. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Well, and first of all, in all the time you've covered the court, has there ever been a situation like this?
No, of course not. I don't know whether I'm looking forward to covering the court remotely, but I approach it with some trepidation, whether I can execute the way I want to execute. But other than that, it's a little heart-stirring in a way.
Well, how is it going to work exactly for the court to hear oral arguments remotely?
Well, we don't know all the details, but oral arguments will resume for the first 2 weeks of May. They will be hearing a bunch of cases that they consider time-sensitive or for other reasons very important to take care of sooner rather than later. A lot of other cases appear as though they're going to be put over until next term. But the system laid out in a press release from the court is that this will be a telephone oral argument. And the audio will be made available to the media for live streaming. The court has never done that before. The counsel will be not there. The justices will be not there. They will all be in their homes. And it's going to be, I suspect, very different from a normal argument in which typically you have, you know, you can have as many as 75 questions from the justices in a half hour. And they step all over each other. And sometimes the Chief Justice has to sort of make order. But in this case, I suspect it's going to be a good deal more stilted because without making eye contact, it's very hard to ask follow-up questions and to know when another justice is going to speak. So they haven't told us how they're going to orchestrate this.
So, Nina, the big case that a lot of people are talking about is in regards to President Trump's financial records. We've been watching this for some time. Remind us of the details of this case.
The lower courts have upheld a set of subpoenas for information sought from President Trump's accountants, longtime accountants, and banks that extended him large multi-million dollar loans. And Congress sought that information, including the president's tax returns from before he was president, to determine whether additional legislation is needed to stiffen up the ethics laws, to require a future president to disclose his or her taxes. The lower courts upheld those subpoenas as within Congress's purview. A separate subpoena issued by a grand jury in New York for information relating to alleged hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels and another woman. Again, the lower courts have upheld that grand jury subpoena in a criminal case. All of those are before the Supreme Court. Trump has intervened to say, I'm immune from subpoenas like this, period. And now it's before a court that has been quite deferential to executive power with a 5-justice conservative majority, but nonetheless with a history, a Supreme Court history, of upholding subpoenas, for example, in a criminal case against President Nixon, and upholding the requirement that President Clinton testify in a civil case against him. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what's going to happen, but they're very important cases.
Nina, I have one more thing I want to ask you about before we let you go, because as you know, Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live reprised her Ruth Bader Ginsburg impression over the weekend with some exercise tips for people stuck at home. Listen to this.
So today I'm going to be working all the major muscle groups of the body. We got the abs, gams, tuchus, chicken wings, and critical thinking.
Nina, what do you know about how the justices are handling the quarantine themselves?
Well, I know that Justice Ginsburg is continuing her workout, but at home now. And she does push-ups, and she does full planks. And I can't do either. I do need planks. But I've got some machines at home, and I'm trying to work out every day on the theory that if she can do it, so can I. Right. I don't know what the other justices are doing. Justice Breyer, I know, is at his home in Cambridge with his wife and his daughter and a passel of grandchildren who live with him there. And I'm sure that's got to be an interesting way to have to really hunker down and work. You know, they all have law clerks, and they're in touch with their law clerks by phone. And they have different systems for retrieving information if they need it from the office. They're not probably like me, who went to NPR yesterday. There was not a soul in my area where I work, and I just pulled out probably another 40 or 50 files to take home with me, because I don't think we're going back till June, if then.
If then, exactly. That is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Be safe.
You too. And now, Robin, let's all do a full plank for Justice Ginsburg.
I never say if she can do something, I can do it. Ever.
Ever. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.